know if you matter? How do you know if your life has any real meaning or significance to it? There's a scene in the movie Rocky. The whole movie is really about that question. How does Rocky know if he matters? And Rocky's avenue for proving that he matters is boxing. And he's been working his way up, and it's right before his kind of big chance. He's about to fight the champ. And Rocky doesn't think he has any chance of winning the fight. But he still sees it as a way to find out if he really matters. So the night before the fight, he can't sleep, and he's wandering around. He finally comes back, and he sits down on the bed, and he says to his girlfriend, Adrian, I don't think I can win. I just want to go the distance. Nobody's ever gone the distance with the champ. And if that final bell rings and I'm still standing, then I'll know, for the first time in my life, I'll know that I'm not just another bum from the neighborhood. If I can box for 12 rounds with Apollo Creed, then I'll know that I matter. Rocky's idea is that there's a specific achievement or accomplishment, and if he gets across that finish line, if he goes the distance, then he'll matter. The ancient world, including the world of Israel that Jesus grew up in, came at this question of significance, of mattering, a little differently. They took for granted that you matter if you are honored, if you are recognized as mattering by other people, then you matter. And that, like the people in the ancient world, they would have agreed that you can get that recognition, that honor, by achievement, as Rocky did. But that's not the only way to know that you matter. It can come through relationship as well. Like the very start of life, a baby comes out of the womb hungry for milk and recognition. Two things. Feed me and honor me. And if that baby, which we hope it happens, is honored, it's not because of anything that the baby has achieved. It is because of the relationship. It's interesting that even in a film like Rocky, which is about the sort of individual achieving honor, in his moment of self-doubt, his crisis about whether he matters or not, he goes to the person he's closest to and asks Adrian to honor him, listen to him, treat him as if he matters enough to wake up in the middle of the night and listen to his doubts. We know if we matter to someone. The only mattering that really lands and stays in our souls is the mattering that's communicated from one person to another. The story that Linda read for us has two closely related scenes, and both of them have people in them wrestling with this question. How do I know if I matter? In the first scene, we meet this man with dropsy, which is sort of grotesque swelling of the soft tissue. This is a person whose life has taught him, I definitely don't matter. Right. And then in the second scene focuses on the Pharisees, the religious teachers, who are people who know, like, if I can do the right things and make the right moves, then I'll matter. But they're both wrestling with the same question. I want to start with the second scene, the parable that Jesus tells at this banquet about how we know if we matter. So Jesus, he's been invited to a meal at the house of a ruler of the Pharisees, kind of a, you know, the most respected local pastor in an area. The Pharisees are roughly equivalent to church pastors. This is the guy that all of the other church pastors go and ask their questions to. Right? And all the other pastors are invited, and they're all gathering together, and they understand that a meal is a chance to maneuver for honor, a place where who matters most gets sorted out. Now, it's this sort of weird combination of cooperation, right? If we invite each other over to dinner, then we're honoring one another and reassuring one another that we matter. But at the same time, competition. Because there's a clear hierarchy at these dinners. They would sit on a sort of U-shaped table, right? And the host sat at the center, and then the place of highest honor was at the host's right hand, and then at the host's left hand, and then one spot removed on the right and one spot removed on the left, all the way down to the person that were like, well, I guess we have to fill the table, so we'll invite him, right? All the way down on this side. Right? So there's a clear visual hierarchy. You could think of a band or a symphony that is gathered together to cooperate in making beautiful music, and yet everyone is aware of who the first violin is, because that is the place of higher honor than second. I still have vivid memories of trying out for the Culbreth Middle School basketball team. I grew up in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where the two most important religious denominations are not Catholic and Baptist, they're Carolina and Duke. Right? And so there were 400 boys at Culbreth Middle School, and like 280 of them show up for basketball tryouts. Right? And we're competing for 12 spots, 12 places of honor. But part of the competition is showing that you're a good teammate, and like encouraging and honoring the guy next to you in line who you definitely don't want to get one of the spots, because that reduces your odds, right? This dinner is just like that, right? Or the sort of never-ending treadmill of competitive cooperative honor in academics, right? Where we compete for the places of honor at the top of the class rank so we can get the places of honor at the best universities, so we can get our names onto the most honorable papers that are being published by that university. It's very much all this competition to show that I matter. Because I actually did end up getting one of the spots on the Culbreth Middle School basketball team, and I've known that I matter ever since. Because we're never really sure, are we? Really, that the high from being sure that I mattered lasted about until the first practice the next afternoon. And then it was back to competing amongst the 12 of us for who matters most on the basketball team. The Pharisees are caught up in this competition, and so they're maneuvering for the places of honor. And Jesus notices this, and he tells them a parable. And it's honestly, even for Jesus standards, it's a pretty strange parable. On the surface, it sounds like, you know, pragmatic, tactical tips for how to win the honor competition. The best maneuvers, right? It's really like, don't get caught in the worst case scenario where you sit down in the chair of the first violinist and the conductor has to come up and say, you're not good enough for that chair in front of everyone. Get up and move and let the real musician have the seat. Right? So Jesus' advice comes across as like, here's how you don't finish last in the honor game. That's what it sounds like on the surface. But Luke really wants to make sure that we don't stop there. So he says, and Jesus told them a parable, which is always your clue that the meaning is not on the surface. It's down deep, somewhere in the roots. So I want you to try to imagine yourself in whatever scenario honor really matters to you. Right? Trying out for something, a family reunion, right? Whatever it is. Following Jesus' advice. I'm gonna take the lowest and least place. And then Jesus is clear, the host may invite you up higher, which means that the host may not. So in order to follow his advice, you have to be at peace with being left, overlooked, and unnoticed, and you have to be at peace with having the spotlight on you while you are called up to the place of honor. You have to be all right with your mom and dad showing up to your game and being the two loudest people in the stands. And you have to be all right with your mom and dad not showing up to your game because they chose to go to your sister's concert instead. You have to be all right at the end of your career with your whole company throwing you a huge, embarrassing retirement party. And you have to be all right with the next week when nobody's emailing you, nobody's consulting with you, nobody is interested in your contributions. Only if you are at peace with both of those scenarios can you listen to what Jesus says to do. I think I do know some people who are okay in both of those situations, but it's a short list. Most of us are either 0 for 2 or 1 for 2 on that. How can you be at peace not getting any recognition or getting all the recognition? How can you be all right in either scenario? Only if you have an absolutely reliable, rock-solid source of recognition. The need to be recognized, to be honored, to have others say that you matter, that's a totally legitimate human need. Your desire for that is natural and good. The question is, how do we try and meet that desire? What fulfills it? Right? We're made for this. Haley's taking AP psychology, and she was telling me this week about, is it Jung, who talks about, like, for kids to flourish, they need unconditional positive regard. Did I get that phrase right? Right? Unconditional positive regard from mom and dad. That's what helps a child flourish, which is just a whole lot of syllables to say honor. Right? You matter to me. Right? That's what sets us off to flourish. We can survive without that, but we can't be at peace. We cannot thrive without that kind of honor. And Jesus wisely and deliberately ends his parable with the promise of that kind of honor, right? He's been telling them about the scenarios, and then he says in verse 11, to sum things up, "For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." A word there changed, and it's really important. Earlier in the parable, if you follow Jesus' advice at an ordinary dinner party, the host may invite you up. It was possible. And everyone in the room would have understood the condition under which the host would invite you up, which is if the host would get some honor from having you right next to him. These things were sort of cooperative honor games, where I host a party and I invite the, most tables sat about 9, I invite the 8 people who I hold in highest regard, who matter most to me, and who I want to hold me in high regard, to think that I matter. And I seat them based on who can do the most for me in treating me as if I matter. That's the way it worked. And so in the regular human world, Jesus' advice is a risk-reward thing. Right? You won't get invited up just because. Right? You don't get a spot on the team or first chair just because. You get the first chair if you can make the symphony sound good. You get the spot on the team if you can contribute to winning. Except in one scenario. The scenario in which the host already has everything that he needs and is not looking for you to reassure him that he matters. If there's a host who is not hungry for honor or for recognition. He will invite you in, and he will say, friend, move up higher, come closer to me. I want to be with you, not because you can offer me anything at all, but because you, not your contributions, you matter to me. Jesus is promising them, is promising us, that God is the host who will always invite you up higher. Because it's you who matters to him, not the honor you can offer him. Right? God is not up in heaven thinking, man, I really hope that Zach has nice things to say to me, say about me today on Sunday morning. Then I will know that I matter. Right? He's never thought that way about any of us. And yet he wants us with him. He is the one and only source in the universe of really unconditional, positive regard, of love that is absolutely steadfast. And if we can experience love from him, if we can believe, not just intellectually, but with our whole selves and with our lives, that the person who matters most in the universe means it when he says, you matter to me, then we can start to be at peace. No matter what honor and recognition we receive at the dinner party or the tryouts or the whatever. Then and only then, which means, how do we experience that? Like I absolutely mean it with all my being. You matter to God. For most of you, that doesn't land. Even if you believe it intellectually, it doesn't really sink in and become the kind of experience that an infant has with their loving mother looking them in the eye and delighting in them. So how is it that we actually experience that mattering to God, that honor from heaven? There are a lot of ways to answer that question. The specific one that Jesus points us to in this text is what we're going to focus on. He says the way we experience it is humbling ourselves. Whoever humbles himself will be exalted, will be called up higher, will be invited to come and sit next to the host in the feast of heaven. So how do we humble ourselves? Right. Humbling yourself, let us be very clear right up front, does not mean being down on yourself. I'm so awful is not humility. Rather, humbling yourself means practicing being free of the honor game. Not being consumed by how you're doing in the competition to have other people recognize that you matter. And we see that Jesus, he invites different people who are in different positions to humble themselves in different ways, just in the first half of this text. I want you to see each of the ways that Jesus invites people to humble themselves. And they, hopefully one of them applies to you because they cover pretty broad basis. Okay, so in the first half of the story that sets up the dinner party where Jesus tells this story, this parable, Jesus, he's been invited to the party and he's on the way, right? And at this point in his ministry, everywhere Jesus goes, a lot of people go. Right? He's got his disciples traveling with him. The word is going ahead of him so that any village or town he enters, the people come out and watch. And there, amongst this crowd is a man with dropsy, or the modern word is edema. If you've seen someone who's ankle is almost as big around as their waist, or who has a bulge somewhere on their torso that really doesn't belong there. That's edema. Right? This is incredibly painful, as you might expect. It's disabling. Your body doesn't function in basic ways. You don't have the strength or the ability to do ordinary tasks. It was isolating. The cultural assumption was if your body was so physically distorted, it must be because you had in some way offended God. You were sinning or you were unclean, and so people would stay away from you. Instead of communicating you matter, they would consistently communicate the opposite. So like this is a person who life is taught, like, give up on the game. You are going to lose every single time. Nobody is going to even let you into the tryouts, much less onto the team. You don't matter at all. If you've been following along in the Gospel of Luke, you wouldn't even need to read the rest of the text to know how Jesus is going to respond to this guy. Right? Every time Jesus encounters someone who has learned from life that they don't matter, Jesus lives out the counterexample. When he meets the man full of leprosy in chapter 5, when he meets the tax collector and says, I'm going to eat at your house, when he meets the adulterous woman at a dinner party full of Pharisees, and he meets the woman who has such a bad bleeding problem and is so ashamed and unclean that she tries to get healing from Jesus without getting noticed at all, because she knows that getting noticed leads to being ashamed. When he sees, just a few verses earlier, the bent woman lurking in the back of the synagogue, wanting to hear him teach, but not wanting to be thrown out by the first person who notices her, Jesus always responds the same way, by doing everything he can to say, come here. You matter to me. The text is deceptively simple here, and especially in translation. Verse 4, Jesus took the man and healed him and sent him away. The word took means like took hold of, seized onto, held firm, right? This man no one would go within 20 feet of, Jesus goes up to and embraces. And then he heals him. The swelling disappears. And then it says Jesus sends him away. That's a, to be fair, really hard word to translate into English. The root of it is release or set free. And then Luke tacks on to the beginning of the word, the prefix for moving away. So it means something like he sends him away from his condition of disability and isolation and shame. Right. What Jesus is doing here is not just saying, hey, you've got a problem and I know how to fix the problem. Right. He is going about fixing the problem in a way that communicates to the man and to everyone watching, you matter to me. You have nothing to offer in the game of honor, and you matter to me. Because I was never interested in what you had to offer. I was only ever interested in you. If you are a person whom life has taught you have nothing to offer, and the only way that you could play the game of reaching out for honor was to avoid shame, to try to not be noticed, because being noticed means being exposed, means being disregarded and dishonored. Jesus is the exception. Jesus is the one who seeks you out to say, you matter to me. Not what you ever had to offer, you. And if you are a person like that, then humbling yourself means turning away from your lack of an honor resume, a whole list of reasons that you try to stay out of the game and try to go unnoticed, saying, that's not what matters. I want to move towards freedom from the game. I want to move towards believing that I matter to Jesus. And the way you do that is you have to do something that the man with dropsy didn't have to do. Right? He wore his lack of a resume on his sleeve, so to speak. It was there for everyone to see all of the time. Right? If you lack, you know, the academic resume or the career resume or the parenting resume or the, you know, good Christian church person resume or whatever it is, you can keep that hidden most of the time. It's much easier for you to stay in the shadows where the honor game has taught you to live. The way you humble yourself is you choose to step out of the shadows and let Jesus, which usually means let someone who is a member of the body of Jesus on earth, the church, see. And it's a risk. It is a horrible risk, but you take the risk of that person responding to you the way Jesus always responds to people like you. Because that's what you need. You need to be honored, recognized, shown by someone else that you matter. And for that to happen, you have to be seen. That's what humbling yourself looks like. If you are that person, that first type of person whom life has taught, do everything you can to stay out of the game, you'll lose. Jesus doesn't stop there, though. He takes how he honors and celebrates and recognizes this man, and he uses it to show this other group of people that they are, if anything, more sick than the man with dropsy. He takes the healing of this man to show the Pharisees, the pastors, the consequences of their quest for honor. There's this very one-sided and dialogue that takes place around the healing. Right? So this is maybe even been set up by the Pharisees to have this man here on the Sabbath day when they had decided you weren't supposed to heal people on the Sabbath day unless they were going to die that day, and dropsy's not lethal, so Jesus wasn't supposed to heal him. Jesus knows this, and so he, verse 3, responded to the lawyers and the Pharisees, responded even though they hadn't said anything. Jesus can read their hearts and respond to the thoughts inside their heads. It's a sobering thought. Jesus responded to them, and they said, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. They stay quiet because they think Jesus is going to expose himself by breaking their version of the law. Jesus, unintimidated, takes the man and heals him and sends him on his way. And then Jesus says to the same lawyers and Pharisees, "Which of you, having a son or an ox that has fallen into a well on a Sabbath day, will not immediately pull him out?" And they could not reply to these things. They no longer chose to stay quiet. They could not reply. Why is that? Because Jesus just exposed the real reason they have for objecting to this man's healing. It's not that Jesus healed him on the Sabbath day. Right? Because they would have, if they had a son, a child, fall into a well, or even if they had an ox fall into a well, they would rescue them right then on the Sabbath day. Which, for the record, is way more work than what Jesus did. Right? Jesus gave a guy a hug. That's the work that he did. I want you to, like, this is supposed to be sort of vivid and absurd, so I want you to imagine with me. Like, a well in the ancient world, it was pretty big, right? So it's, you know, if you kind of made a circle around the front of the platform. So an ox could actually fall down the well, right? But now, there is a 1,000-pound animal at the bottom of a well, and we're going to get him out. Now we have, I don't even know how many engineers and some construction people in the room, right? Like, we have the capability to do that, right? With so much work. We'd have to build some kind of apparatus above the top of the well that was strong enough to hold a rope that was strong enough to hold an ox and haul it out. Somebody's got to go into the well and harness the terrified ox to a rope. I'm not volunteering for that job. That sounds a lot like working on the Sabbath. That would be a violation of the commandment. Right? Then, somebody smarter than me could calculate the force times distance equals work to get the ox up, plus, like, you got the friction of the pulley system, and Ron's over there like, yes, I can do that. Right? You want to talk about work. And if the ox survived the fall, staying in the well for a day is not lethal. It all could wait till the next day. But they would rescue the ox. Jesus is exposing their objection to his healing has nothing to do with keeping the Sabbath of God, and everything to do with this unclean man having nothing to offer in the honor game. They wouldn't heal him on any day, because on any day, going near enough would be exposing themselves to uncleanness, would be moving down the ladder and into a place of lower honor. And when Jesus exposes the consequences, which these are always the consequences when the successful people stay committed to the honor game, is that all the people who are less successful and less well set up to play the game are shamed and isolated. Now they can't say anything. For those of us in the room who can do well at the honor game, Jesus is warning us. Us, right? I have the highest place of human honor in our little congregation. Right? Jesus is warning us. Our quest for the places of honor, to get them and keep them, has consequences not just for ourselves, but for those around us. And Jesus is telling us to humble ourselves. Which for us, for those, I'm going to keep saying us because my world is full of people honoring me. It's quite dangerous spiritually. For us, humbling ourselves means abandoning the game, which it's way harder to stop playing a game you have a good chance of winning. Means walking away from a possible victory in order to do what? Well, Jesus shows us in the text, in order to walk toward the person who can't help us win. For potential winners to humble ourselves, we follow in the way of Jesus by moving deliberately towards those who have never won. That's what it is for us to humble ourselves. Henry Nouwen, who played the honor game early in his life well enough that I'm assuming some of you have heard of him, he, for the first half century or so of his life, he crushed it in the academy-specific honor game. So he gets a master's degree and a doctorate, and then he goes on to teaching positions at Notre Dame and at Yale and at Harvard. Places of honor. Right. He's publishing books. He's on lecture tours. Right. If he came to Corvallis, he would sell out the LaSalle Stewart Center in a blink. Right. And then the Holy Spirit gets a hold of Henry. And he leaves his tenured faculty position. He leaves his lecture tours and he moves to a town in Ontario to live in a L'Arche community. Community homes set up for developmentally disabled adults. And his primary work for the last 15 years of life is he is the one-on-one companion for a man named Adam. Adam is incapable of speech. Adam certainly cannot understand the profound, insightful and well-worded sentences Henry is so capable of producing. He humbles himself. He moves away from the game he had gotten so good at winning and toward the person who had never won anything. That's what it is for us potential winners to humble ourselves. This can be done less drastically than Henry Nouwen's story. And you should know that some of Nouwen's most beloved books were published after he left Harvard and went to live at L'Arche. So this is not about never doing anything that might lead to honor. This is about not being governed by the honor game, not deriving our identity from the place we have managed to achieve. It's about being free from that. And the measure of our freedom being the capacity to deliberately make moves that have no value in the honor game, that cannot possibly improve our place. And you can do that still sitting on the faculty at OSU. You can do that from a position of management in your company or from having the highest class rank in your school. But you can only do it if that position on the faculty or the management team or that class rank is not how you know that you're not just another bum from the neighborhood. You can only do it if those positions, those places of honor, are not how you know that you matter. Which is another way of saying you can do it if you know you matter because you matter to God. You can do it if you know you matter because you matter to Jesus. You can do it if you know that while we were yet his enemies, Christ died for us, took up the place of least honor anyone has ever held, stretched naked and bloodied on a tree for all to see. Not because we had anything to offer him, but because we mattered to him. And that belief, that trust in God's unconditional positive regard, it actually can start to sink in as we practice unconditional positive regard for someone else. The possibility that someone could love me like that will become more real as I practice loving someone like that. And those kinds of relationships start to seem possible. If I live in a world where every relationship is either clearly or kind of subtly under the surface transactional, I'm here because there's some honor to be gotten, then the idea that God is not that way, that he is not in relationship with me in order to get anything out of it, but because I matter to him, becomes less plausible and less possible. You see how as we humble ourselves, experiencing God's love, experiencing mattering personally to him, can start to sink in. It's a kind of positive feedback loop. Right? I start, here's this Jesus who keeps treating people who have nothing to offer as if they matter infinitely to him. That could apply to me too. I might not be the exception to the Jesus rule. And if that's true, then I am free to treat the person who comes into my life and has nothing to offer as if they matter. And as I practice that, the unconditional positive regard of God starts to make lived, intuitive sense. And my faith that Jesus actually went to the cross for me, not to get something out of me, starts to grow. And I'm less subject to having to prove to myself that I matter by achieving and earning recognition, and more free to love someone who has nothing to offer me in terms of honor and recognition, which will then lead to me being able to really believe that Jesus loves me because I matter to him, which will then set me free, and on and on and on. This is the life of faith. Paul said it in one sentence, what I just took 25 sentences to say. For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son, much more now that we are reconciled, shall we be saved by his life. That the word by there is wonderfully flexible. Saved by the means of him offering his life, yes. Saved through the way he lived his life, yes. Saved for learning to live our lives in the same way, yes. All of the above. Recognizing just how much we matter to God releases us to live inside of God's economy of mattering, where there don't need to be trades. There don't need to be risk-reward calculations. Where honor flows freely from the throne of heaven into our hearts and through our hands to be shared with whomever the throne of heaven brings before us on earth. That is the life by which you were saved. That is the life for which you are saved. That is the life of Jesus. Let's pray.